This episode of The Blotter Presents is brought to you, in part, by Best Evidence subscribers. Thanks, guys. A subscription to Eve Beatty's and my True Crime Review newsletter gets you the true crime that's worth your time every weekday. It's just $5 a month, and it makes a great gift. Head to bestevidence.fyi and sign up today. And now, the episode.
He was 21 years old. He'd appeared in one movie and released one album. Now the vice president was calling him a villain and a menace.
Slate's Slow Burn podcast turns its attention from politics to hip-hop in its third season on the murders of Biggie Smalls and Tupac Shakur. How does it compare to other coverage of this preoccupying and still unsolved case? Later, we're going to talk about the CBC/VG joint podcast, Hunting Warhead, which shines a light into the worst, darkest corners of the dark web. Are the roaches that come scuttling out too upsetting, or do they take too long to show up? Conspiracies abound in The Blotter Presents, episode 122. Welcome back to The Blotter Presents, a podcast that looks at how true crime is told and sold. I'm your host, Sarah D. Bunting, and I am most thankful to Toby Ball for returning to the guest chair this Thanksgiving week. Hello, Toby.
Hey, happy Thanksgiving week.
Thank you, and to you. I'm also thankful that we managed to iron out the 23 minutes of technical problems that plagued the beginning of this record. Truly, we are
happy holidays.
To doing this podcast and to keeping Toby off the roof as much as possible. Let us get into it with our first most wanted section. That's season three of Slate's Slow Burn podcast. The first two seasons addressed Nixon and Clinton. This is quite a bit different. Here's the case file from the landing page on Slate. Season 3 tackles the murders of Tupac Shakur and the notorious B.I.G. The story takes place at a moment when hip-hop was taking over pop culture, and a former theater kid from the Bay Area and a one-time crack dealer from Brooklyn were changing the music forever. They went from friends to enemies, and they ended up victims of a deadly rivalry between two rap scenes. How is it the two of the most famous performers in the world were murdered within a year of each other, and their killings were never solved? That's an excellent question, and it's one that you and I have actually talked about before on this podcast regarding Unsolved, which was the scripted take on this case. I thought well of those episodes that I watched and then never watched the rest. So I'm wondering how you think this podcast compares to other properties on the same topic that you have consumed, Toby. Did you like this? Are you going to keep going?
This one, I don't know. I might keep going. It's very rare that I keep going after I've done a show, quite honestly, just because I end up listening and watching so much stuff.
Yeah.
But I guess we'll get into it. I was more hyped up for it until the last episode, and it just seemed like it really slowed way the hell down. So I might give it another one because I think it's strange in that it's kind of like this, you know, this is all playing out like right after I got out of college, I think. Mm-hmm. And, but I honestly don't know that much about it. Like I would say the most I know is from watching those few episodes of that TV show that we reviewed. And I too didn't watch it again after that. So, I'm a little ignorant.
I thought this was good. I only listened to two episodes, life and other work got in the way, but I think I will keep going. I do think that it is trying to do something quite ambitious and almost like the way that OJ Made in America took him and his life and put him against this like horrible backdrop of racism, violence in the African-American community, police corruption, the corrosive influence of power and celebrity, et cetera, and so on. I suspect that Slow Burn is trying to create a similar canvas, but I'm not sure. I'm just not sure that, I mean, I think it's, you know, great to be ambitious, obviously, but there is something about this particular production that's like, I feel like the construction and the execution of it are not quite like big enough for what maybe it thinks it's trying to do. I don't know if you agree with that.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, so I've listened to all 4 episodes that have been out so far. And it did kind of take, like, I agree with you in that if you're using those two guys, Tupac and Biggie, as, and like kind of placing their story within like these larger societal forces, and some of which are very, and some very specific, like city forces, I guess.
Yeah.
You would say, especially in LA.
For sure.
That would be good. And I think they do that. They do some of that, but then it, like, especially in, I think, the 4th episode, which I was listening to on the commute this morning, it really gets into some politics stuff and ways in which people, like, you know, leaders in the African American community, kind of come out against, you know, quote unquote, quote, gangster rap.
Right.
For both, violent and misogynistic imagery. And I think, was it the 2nd episode that has the stuff with the police unions?
Yes.
And like Dan Quayle.
Yeah. And there's like a lengthy, digression, maybe discursion is a better word, which I probably just used wrong. Feel free to add me. Yes. It's been a long month, people.
It's live podcasting.
Yeah. That into like the bet, like Ice-T versus the world. But at the sort of top of episode 1, there is this moment where he's talking to a guy who was present when Tupac got shot in New York, and then went to stay with Jasmine Guy to recuperate, which I thought was really an interesting detail. But the tone of the clip that we're about to hear is quite a bit different from the rest of it. Here's clip 2.
But why are they rolling him off the elevator? He looking at us against the wall, and he's like, he's saying, fuck you niggas. But the middle finger, you ain't see the picture?
I seen the picture of him stick up. I thought that was to the media, though.
No, that was to us.
Chico was telling me that this was it. This was the moment when allies became enemies. I'd seen the photo, but I hadn't seen that. What else had I missed?
He sort of goes from this very like colloquial, like exchange of information. And then in the same clip, he retreats back from that to a more like predictable public radio. Like, what else had I missed this season, right, on Slow Burn? Right. That suggested to me, I mean, there is, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that he thinks there is some magical key in the information that we already have, but may have misinterpreted, that will solve this puzzle. Because I think that this case really stays with people, and they're, you know, they really want to solve it and don't understand why it hasn't been solved. But I also think that maybe it's not going to be solved. So if you're creating a narrative about it, I think you have to decide, are you going to be a little more relatably nosy, like Missing Maura Murray? Or are you going to really try to take a huge Edelman swing at it, like OJ Made in America, and try to put it in larger context? And I'm not entirely sure that the podcast has decided.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm full of shit that. Also, maybe I'm just taking a big swing that is too ambitious.
You know, I don't know. I think you're probably right. So there, It's a little frustrating, and I wish I hadn't listened to the last episode, because I think I'd be more positive about it, because I thought the last episode really kind of went in the wrong direction as far as at least keeping my interest, because then it really became about, you know, sort of older leaders in the Black community pushing back against rap.
Right.
And, you know, in a way that I don't think reflected that that well, or at least wasn't very nuanced. I mean, I think there were sort of nuanced criticisms of it, but these were people who were really seemed to be seeking publicity and exposure by making these sort of broad claims, and then lumping in things like Two Live Crew with NWA. And I don't feel like those are necessarily comparable in terms of just about everything. Two Live Crew seemed like kind of a ridiculous circus, and NWA were like genuine sort of groundbreakers.
Yeah, like sociological commentators. I mean, I think that there are multiple, you know, books, podcasts, PhD theses on pretty thin slices of 90s hip hop culture and how it was used by the political power structure in various ways. But I'm not sure that if you're trying to do a, if you're trying to do just a narrative about this particular, like these two men, I think you're better off just sticking to that, or to one of them. Because there was a documentary that we talked about also on this podcast. I believe it was episode 22. It'll be in the show notes. About just Biggie Smalls, that I think managed to get its arms around the subject in a much better, deeper way, because it didn't try to bring everything in to a conversation that's really about, like, but seriously, who killed these guys? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think so. And again, I think this might have been the third episode, so I don't think you've heard this, but they have sort of an extended piece about one of the, you know, it was like Vibe magazine's hip hop awards or something.
Right.
And where the East Coast and the West Coast factions were both there.
Oh yeah.
And people were basically freaking out that there was going to be a gun battle, and
like during the show.
Yeah.
Like there's, I think there's extended footage of that during, in that documentary I just mentioned. And it's like, it's tense. Like, you know, Puffy is like getting catcalled. Like, it's, I mean, I don't know how much of that they put in episode three of Slow Burn.
They put in a fair amount. It's pretty interesting in that there's a guy named Danny Boy, who I guess was like 16 or something at the time. And he said they get into their hotel room and they've got this like duffel bag full of guns. And like all these guys who are going to the awards are like pulling out guns.
Jesus.
And Danny Boy goes to grab one. And I think it's Suge Knight's like, what are you doing? And he was like, oh, I thought I was supposed to get one. He's like, yeah, put that down. But yeah, so they do talk about the
when
different...
Suge Knight is telling people to put guns down.
Yeah.
Huh. Okay.
So it's yeah, I mean, again, I think in my mind, if it had been a little bit, if they could keep it a little more focused, and I understand the idea of trying to put a context of like sort of what pressure and what the public reaction was to these, you know, records that these young guys were putting out. You know, they're in their early 20s.
Yeah.
And they're getting pushback from the president and the vice president and Bob Dole and
Bill Clinton,
the police unions and all this stuff. And, you know, it's got to be pretty heady. And then Tupac's in jail for a while.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's got to be kind of surreal.
Well, and there's also, I mean, I understand that it's almost not possible to sort of paint the narrative picture without bringing in all these threads of like, here's what had been happening on the cultural landscape regarding hip hop. Here's how politicians had been involving themselves. Here is actual like textual evidence in hip hop of the relationship to law enforcement. And then you have this double event that like the people around both of these murder victims are like at the same time, why hasn't this been solved? And we're not telling you shit. So, right. I mean, you have to bring in some context. Otherwise, it's just like, you know, none of this happened in a vacuum. But where do you stop in terms of like, you know, in the beginning, there was the gramophone. Like, okay.
Right.
You need to narrow it down. But our next clip is one of the guys who I think was played by Jimmy Simpson in Unsolved, talking about the immediate unsolvable posture in which this case found itself. Here is clip three.
Back in 1994, the people who knew what happened weren't talking, definitely not to the police. Detective Mordecai Jakansky says he knew the case would be nearly impossible to solve.
From the get-go, there was zero. Let me use the word zero cooperation, meaning that nobody was talking to us, which was understandable. I'm not complaining about it. It was part of the cycle, because this was a situation where nobody wants to be a rat.
That, and they have a legitimate apprehension about it, you know, any contact with law enforcement is going to end up with charges on them because they're people of color. So,
right. And then they look like snitches.
Yeah. Not to mention that if this is, you know, if this is all sort of being encouraged by record label honchos and managers and stuff like that, and I'm not saying it was, but if it was, it is in their like public relations interest to have this taken care of from within and continue the narrative in a way that gets attention.
This is one of the things that they haven't gotten into, at least so far, is sort of contrasting the two as far as like their backgrounds and sort of savvy. There was a New Yorker article, you know, probably 20 years ago, if not more, about Tupac's death. And they make a case about, you know, he was a theater kid. Like he was, you know, it wasn't like he had it easy. They were very poor at times. And, you know, I think there was mental health and addiction issues. But, you know, still, you know, Tupac, he was an entertainer more than a gangster, and that when he started hanging out with gangsters, like he didn't necessarily understand what the ramifications of how he would act around them. And so there was always this tension about, was he going to screw up and insult somebody?
Right.
Or take, assume an ability to interact with somebody in a way that he shouldn't.
Right.
And and I think that's the thing where he's like giving the finger to those guys after he was shot.
Yeah. Well, and it's there's a list somewhere in the first or second episode of his law enforcement contact to date and how the alleged sexual assault charge was a whole different kettle of fish. And the list is just like, in my notes, I was like, this is just a 20-year-old being 20. Like, you know, maybe stoned and or drunk and like right. A jackass, like a 20-year-old jackass. But like, you know, charged with slapping someone or like drunk and disorderly. Like a lot of the charges were like, they're not gangster level charges. And for, you know, Topher Shakur, they're probably not charges at all. Let's face it.
Right.
But yeah, right. I got to hunt down that New Yorker article and put it in the show notes because I think that contrast between him and Biggie also, not to mention between Tupac and his own environment. I don't know. Like there are a lot of different stories in here that as I was listening to the podcast, I was like, "What? I wish this podcast were about X or about Y." Right. I wish it were like just about the Shakur family. I wish it were like, why isn't there a podcast about like the world according to Ice-T?
Right.
I mean, like his whole thing and like, you know, trading diss tracks with Def Jeff and stuff like that, which they don't get into. But occasionally I fall down a like Google hole with this stuff. And I really found myself wishing that there was, not that there was more context, because I agree that this needs to be more focused, but that the contexts could be spun off into their own podcasts. Speaking of Ice-T, here is some of that context as Ice-T talks to Australian television about whether or not he actually wants cops to be murdered. Clip 4.
Here he is being interviewed on Australian TV in 1992.
American people are really up in arms about this song, which doesn't kill. It's just a song. But the cops are in America actually kill kids. This is a very angry song, a song about rage.
Okay, but I understand that you said this in one of your US interviews. I've got no trouble with killing brutal cops. True?
They have no trouble with killing what they consider brutal kids. See, my attitude is that just because you have a badge doesn't give you the right to murder me.
Yeah, like, I just sort of wound up wool gathering about, I don't know, other frameworks in which I want the same sorts of stories to be told to me, like various histories of, like, Ice-T, intra-West Coast beef, and especially since I'm the one person who's still watching Law and Order Special Victims Unit and seeing this somewhat cuddlier and less prickly Ice-T on my TV every week being a police sergeant. It's just interesting. Like, I don't know, someone needs to do the complete Ice-T podcast. I'm putting it in the universe. Universe, hear my cry.
He was on a reality show, wasn't he?
He has had a couple of reality shows, one with his wife Coco, and then he hosted Ice Cold, In Ice Cold Blood, which I believe is still on Oxygen or ID.
Is that like a true crime thing?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, it's just him in the little interstitials being like making terrible puns. But he gets a paycheck.
Awesome.
And it's, you know, I guess not hurting anyone.
Good for him.
Yeah. Episode 2, they did seem to really zag over to another crime completely, in which this guy shot a cop and his attorney. He was playing Tupac's first album, and his attorney crafted a "The Rap Made Me Do It" defense that just steered head on into all the horseshit that old white dudes in Washington were trying to pin on hip hop at the time. Here's clip 5.
They finally pulled me over and I laughed. Remember Rodney King and I blast on this punk ass. Now I got a murder case.
As Tanner listened, he realized he could argue that Tupac's words had gotten inside of Ronald Ray Howard's head.
I didn't know what gangster rap music was at the time, But, you know, here was a young kid from Houston who had had problems with police in his neighborhood. And I was kind of fascinated by this music that he was listening to. And that's where I got the idea to, you know, use that as a potential defense as to why all of this happened.
I'm still not entirely clear on how that would work, but this is another instance where I kind of wished that that were part of a podcast on insane affirmative defenses, like the Twinkie the notorious Twinkie defense, instead of here.
I mean, it's just, yeah. I mean, that whole thing is just such a bunch of horse shit.
I mean, it's look, like, Zealous...
Are you going to bring in Scorsese because, you know, somebody whacked somebody in a restaurant? Like, I never would have thought about it. But I saw him eating some pasta.
Yeah.
I put a cap in him.
Or, you know? I mean, how many times has someone said, say hello to my little friend while committing a murder? Like, are you going to...
It's ridiculous. Yeah, again, I think I think the more we talk about it, the more I think I'm coming around to your point, which is, you know, it's kind of hit and run on some of these things. You know, here's 5 minutes on Tupac being blamed for this cop being killed. That's another reason why cops hate him. And then here's, you know, 6 minutes on Dan Quayle getting a bee in his bonnet about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's all these like different things. And you know, and I guess, you know, they add up to a story, but I don't know. I mean, it's tough because I feel like the Slow Burn franchise, like I thought the first two seasons were excellent.
Yeah, agree.
And so I think there's a lot to live up to. And I think the way, you know, the idea is to come, I think it's to come at the story like not head on necessarily all the time.
Sure. Yeah. It occurs to me as you're saying that, like it is called Slow Burn and maybe I should just give everything a chance to accumulate so that at the final zoom out, everything's there. But this is a slightly different build from previous season. So anyway, sorry to interrupt you.
No. Yeah. I mean, but I'm not a fan of this, like, you got to slog through some episodes without really knowing why they're doing stuff because it'll all become apparent at the end. Because usually I don't have that much confidence that it will.
Yeah.
But well,
we have to listen to a lot of this stuff for, you know, our podcast.
So much.
And it's sort of like, you got 15 minutes to sell this to me, and if you don't, I can't continue. There aren't enough hours in the day. There is a holiday weekend coming up. There is a house to be cleaned, and I think I will stick with this to see where they go, because I am fascinated on a number of fronts, not just true crime, but also like pop music, cultural history. Fascinated by these stories, and I think my frustration is mostly like I wish that I could hit pause and then go and read Rap on Trial or one of the other books that's referenced in the first couple of episodes. Like there's just so much there, and I'm not totally convinced that they have control of the narrative context, but I think I will try to find out. Do you anticipate keeping going with this if you have nothing else to do?
I think I'll probably give it another episode. I think it's interesting enough. And that may just be that I'm not as familiar with the story. Again, like I said, I think episode 4 took kind of a wrong turn for me. I think it got too far afield of like the basic story of these two guys and spent too much time trying to set the social stage for it.
Right.
But again, it's not a bad podcast.
Oh, know? No. I mean, it's professionally it's well done. It's interesting. I wouldn't say it's not, you know, amateurish. It's good. No, it's competently made.
I think it just needs a little more. If I was an editor for it, you know, I'd be like, you know, what's the theme? What's the theme of this episode, and how does it apply to our main story? And I think they kind of lost that in the fourth episode. And there were times when I think they could have tightened things up a little bit. But again, you know, I if we were on Crime Writers On, I'd give it a thumbs up. But just it's not right. Perfect.
Well, and it's funny because I feel like I have spent a lot of time with this story on this podcast. So I don't think that whether you're having some frustrations with the momentum has to do with how much you know about the case. I felt like I wasn't being told things that I had heard a million times. So that is good. I mean, I think it's basically good. It just maybe has some pacing problems and is trying to do a little too much, but it's better than not trying to do enough. So once again, that's Slow Burn. It is a Slate podcast. It is in season 3. I definitely recommend the first 2 seasons. This is definitely a 90-degree turn into another topic, but I think I'm gonna stick with it. All right, we've got another Most Wanted topic coming up. It's another podcast. This one is from the CBC in collaboration with a Norwegian newspaper/magazine concern. Why I can't remember that is something I'll get into in a few minutes. Here's the case file from Apple Podcasts. How do you take down a criminal network that's hidden in the shadows? How do you rescue child abuse victims who could be anywhere in the world? Hunting Moorhead follows the journalists and police on a global mission to expose the darkest corners of the internet. What they discover shocks them. Host Damon Fairless, it's spelled demon, basically, Fairless, tracks down the investigators, survivors, and criminals themselves. A co-production of CBC Podcasts and the Norwegian newspaper VG. Okay, so basically this is the story of a white hat hacker uncovering child abuse and pornography sites and then branching into a much larger area of the dark web. Had you heard of this podcast? Were you listening to this podcast?
We reviewed it for Crime Writers On. So I've digested it and then discussed it. And it is some dark stuff, quite honestly.
Yes, I am many episodes behind on Crime Writers On, as well as basically everything else. Everything. My DVR is like visibly bulging, so please don't take it personally. I'm only like an episode and a half in. I think I am going to keep going, but I'm going to have to take frequent breaks.
Oh, shit. You're not even to the dark stuff yet.
This is a strange one because I think it does some things well, but it's also like, I think the accents like just made me go to this. I won't say I found it soothing. Obviously this, you know, this subject matter is not something that soothes you, but I found it a little hard to like dig into it and concentrate because of the melodic Norwegian accents. And also because it's just, I don't know, like it's a very formulaic, but it doesn't do anything unexpected. Is this something that I can expect to continue or no?
It takes quite a turn.
Ah, I see.
And I don't know if we want to talk about that or not.
But, no, I mean, it's been out a while, so you can feel free.
So I don't know exactly where you are, but have they identified the Canadian guy and the guy from Tennessee who run this huge site? So and then we can get to I'll just sort of briefly tell you. It kind of abandons the the bigger picture to take a look at particularly the Canadian guy.
Okay. Makes sense.
Who's just, so there's two back-to-back episodes. It's like 3 and 4. One of them is they talk to his roommate in Canada about this trip they make down to DC, and the roommate's like this kind of like very nice sort of somewhat nerdy guy who's mostly wants to go to the Kennedy Center and watch The Marriage of Figaro. And the reason why this other guy's gone down there is because he's got this setup with this father to have sex with his 4-year-old daughter. Like he's meeting this guy from Tennessee about that. And then the fourth episode is the most harrowing episode of anything I think I've ever heard, which is his cousin talking about when he came to visit and she has 2 young kids.
Oh my God. Okay.
And well, the whole time, you know, something's going to happen and you just don't know when. And she's just telling this story about him visiting. And it's just, it's just gut wrenching.
Oh.
So it gets super, super dark and in a much more, intimate way than this idea of having, you know, these huge sites with, you know, images and films of child sexual abuse.
That it can still seem a little abstract.
Right.
If you're just hearing about it. Yeah.
I mean, it's, don't get me wrong, it's horrifying. In the place I used to work, like, they did some stuff on that. There was a group that we shared offices with that do trainings for the Department of Justice. They do trainings on how to investigate child pornography production and putting stuff online. So it does get kind of, there's like the macro and there's also the micro, and it's all on this one. So these two guys, but they really focus on the Canadian guy whose name I'm not going to be able to remember. And,
Ben,
you know,
Faulkner?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah.
And he's kind of remorseless, you know? I mean, he's not like...
And they end up talking to him, yeah?
They do end up talking to him, and he's... Like, you know, it's hard to tell whether he doesn't get it or whether... He feels like, you know, he's the only one who does get it.
Okay.
But he's very, without being like threatening or anything like that, it's just clear that if left out, if he got out, he would reoffend. Like he doesn't see what's wrong with what he's done, really. He understands that he would get in trouble for it, but he doesn't understand, like, doesn't fully grasp what he's doing, I would say. The consequences of it to other people.
Right.
So anyway, we should go back and talk about the parts you've seen.
Well,
listen to.
That being the case, if they are moving steadily towards a more personal, like, you know, use the word intimate, which is unfortunate that we have to use it in that context, but I know what you mean. But in the early episodes, they're definitely sort of circling the subject from a much greater distance. And it's more of, and there's a lot more explainer bits, like clip 6.
It's worth understanding a few terms.
ClearNet to open web is everything that you can find through.
The ClearNet accounts for about 10% of what's on the internet. The deep web is the other 90%. All the stuff you can't access through web browsers. So password-protected pages, encrypted sites, that sort of thing. There's also the dark web. Now that's part of the deep web too, but it's also sort of its own beast. It's something we're going to get into more later. For now, all you need to know is that Einar had gone down enough ClearNet rabbit holes to know that there was a lot of child pornography squirreled away across that 10% of the web we all use every day.
That was interesting to me. I did not know those numbers. I think that they are good at explaining things, but not over-explaining. And then I think they're also good, apparently, because I haven't gotten quite far enough into it yet to sort of look to have the overview, but they're also good at slowly sort of circling you closer to what we're really talking about here, like on a granular level. But there's a little bit of that in the first episode.
And, you know, they were either alcoholics or did drugs also. So they had this addiction problem already.
Did you ask them at all whether they had experienced any sexual abuse or trauma?
Yes. Yeah. A couple of them told me that they had probably experienced something. But I mean, the other eight, they hadn't experienced anything. So it's, you can't use that as an excuse.
Did any of them explicitly talk about pedophilia, being attracted to children, as the main cause?
No, all of them told me I'm not a pedophile. All of them told me that.
All of them said that they're not a pedophile.
Yeah.
Yeah, what you were saying before just made me think of that clip, that they're all sort of uniformly denying that they have a problem, or
right,
you know, that it's wrong. Like, they understand that they're supposed to keep it quiet, and they understand they're supposed to hide it and act like they're sorry, but they probably aren't. And, you know, they, like you said, they may not see really.
And I think, yeah. I mean, I get the feeling, I mean, he doesn't quite put it this way. But again, this guy, Ben, he's clearly a pedophile. And I think there are a lot of people with pedophiliac, you know, inclinations who are tortured by it and haunted by it and realize that, you know, what their sexual attraction is, you know, it's a no-go.
And felonious.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And are, you know, it's a real problem, and morally for them. I think there's other, Ben kind of falls into this other group, which is, you know, it's just a societal construct that's keeping me from, you know, pursuing my sexual interests.
Right.
And I, you know, I'm sure
it's like
he can
the NAMBLA
like marshal
argument.
Yeah, exactly. It's like in ancient Greece. This happened all the time, and look how smart they were.
Yeah, and but, also look what happened to them.
Yeah, didn't turn out that well.
No.
Well, although they went on for quite a while. It's interesting. They do talk about how, you know, pedophilia isn't like this sort of monolithic thing. Like, there are right. people who are opportunistic pedophiles, but also have relations with, you know, age-appropriate humans. And then
there's one segment where they're talking about the people who justify their use of these images in terms of like, well, it's that or I actually act on
right.
this is their rationalization, which I mean,
so look at the same as like with prostitutes.
Yeah.
You know, it's like they're saving marriages. You know, it's like, well, I don't know.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah. As long as everyone's consenting, fine. Use whatever rationale you like.
Right.
But a 4-year-old.
Yeah, it's not happening.
No.
They talk about that. I don't know if you got to that part, but about they talk very briefly about, you know, that a guy like Ben, like if like a 4-year-old is like laughing or whatever, takes that as being, this is okay, you know, she's consenting.
Right.
When clearly, you know, she can't, like she doesn't,
Right.
That's not something she can conceive of at that point.
Yeah, that's not how being four works.
Yeah, works. Did you get to the part where they're talking about how the police take over their site and are running their site for a while?
No, I haven't quite gotten there yet.
Yeah, so that's an interesting.
That's where episode one ends. That basically they're like, oh, like they have tracked down the administrator of the site, only to find that, like, you know, they're watching the detectives, basically. So that figures.
Yeah, it's interesting because they basically bust these guys, but they also, you know, these guys had communications on the website, like from the administrators and stuff. So they, like, the police, like, very, very quickly, so that it doesn't seem like there's any break in what's going on. Mm-hmm. So they arrest these two guys and then they start impersonating them online, and they keep the site up and running the way it was. Yeah. As a way of getting other, you know, pedophiles IP addresses and stuff. And they do this for a while. And there's a segment, it's not real long, but it's an interesting question is, you know, what's the morality of that?
Right.
To continue running this child sexual abuse, you know, media site. And they're, you know, what they say is, these are done, right? These things are in existence. They're out there.
Right.
Nobody else is being victimized. We're just using it to prevent further victimization. And the sort of counter argument is, you're the largest clearinghouse for child sexual abuse videos and still photos. You know, that's not good. You know, that's, yeah, not, that's, like, not really a law enforcement
should be destroyed
place. So, and they make the case, like, if we got rid of it, that, you know, others would pop up or whatever. And they actually talked to a woman who had kids abused, and their images were up there. And she's like, did you hear how many people they arrested? She's like, hell yeah. They get more of those guys off the streets and those pictures are already out there. Like, use them. Use them to get those guys. So that was a pretty interesting little segment.
Yeah, there's a segment in one of the first two episodes where they're talking about when this hacker sort of first started doing what he was doing, and sort of creeping around in the dark web and identifying specific people who were, you know, using these images and, like, finding their IPs and then confronting them, which I found very, you know, and then this journalist is doing it as, like, they're sort of doing it as a team, and they consult a psychologist, and it's sort of like, what is the ethics of contacting these people, and what time should I do it when their family won't be home, and might they take their own lives, and so on. And I thought that was an interesting, I mean, that was the context of the last clip, was their conversations with these guys. And, you know, it's almost always guys. That, you know, what is the ethics of confronting these guys and saying, we know what you're doing and we know what you're looking at. You need to stop doing that. You need to, you know, get help, I guess, although my understanding is that I'm not sure this can be helped with some of these guys. I don't know. But yeah, it's good. It's, like, extremely methodical. There's a lot of, at least in the early going, there is some processy stuff as to how the hacker gets to these boards and figures out who the administrators are. And yeah, I mean, I actually have a clip about that, our last clip, which I will play.
I've read the post Dinar's talking about, and I'll spare you the details. But the guy admitted to abusing an 11-year-old, in part by promising the kid a toy, a very specific toy. The guy went by a unique username on Child's Play. Halkin quickly found someone with an almost identical username on Skype and Facebook. On the Facebook page, there was a photo of that same very specific toy mentioned on the Child's Play post. It was circumstantial evidence, but it was enough. Halkin and Einar had an ethical obligation.
Yeah, so we had to take that to the police because this was ongoing abuse.
The police took the information and started an investigation. Einar and Halkin now knew that they could successfully hunt for users on the dark web. But users are small game. Halkin and Einar were after larger prey.
So you were interested in finding out who ran these sites, the administrators.
So that's where you get into the larger story is when they start going after these administrators. This one, I think, even though the subject matter is going to be harrowing, I think I am going to keep going with it. What would you advise?
if you're going to be triggered by stuff about child sexual abuse, you will be triggered by this podcast. Just like right up front, it's very harrowing in parts, especially in the second half. That being said, it's really well done. You know, I think that the reporting is top notch. They really look at a number of levels on which this plays out in the world. And, you know, there's a bunch of sort of interesting questions and issues they bring up, such as, you know, most pedophiles, you know, get counseling for it like post, you know, perpetration.
Post-offense, right.
Post-offense. And so they talk about how in Germany, I think it's in Berlin, somebody actually Facebooked me about this. There's a program where I think the idea is if you realize those proclivities in yourself, that you can get in this program before you act on it,
mm-hmm.
and then receive, you know, counseling or whatever it is they do. But they did this huge like PR thing where, you know, so they had posters and flyers and stuff, and
wow.
It's like this is how you keep yourself out of trouble. You know, we realize it's a mental affliction or whatever, and we want to treat you now rather than wait for something to happen or to have you live, you know, in some sort of existential crisis for the rest of your life.
Right.
So that's kind of interesting. So I would, yeah, again, it's super dark. It's probably the darkest podcast that I've listened to, but it's also, everything about it is excellent. You just, you know, you have to just make a decision about whether that's the kind of content you want to take in, especially during the holidays.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like I talk about enough stories and documentaries on here that are like, you can't really say like, it was great, but it can also be important to like acknowledge this testimony that these things occurred and people survived them and law enforcement enacted justice after them. So, but you know, that's only if you can sort of get through it without harm to yourself. So,
yeah.
Our
double bill for the crime writers that just hit this week was that and the John Demjanjuk. So it was child sexual abuse and the Holocaust back to back.
Yeah.
I was like, this is like when that was done, we're taking this week off. I was like, yeah, I need some time to just like recover.
Yeah. That's a lot.
Many hours of super dark stuff.
We had The Devil Next Door last week and then, you know, a couple of little palate cleansers about, you know, crowd solving cold cases. Like, I just couldn't yeah. put anything real
yeah.
right next to the butcher of Shaker Heights or wherever the fuck he lived. Okay, well, that's Hunting Warhead. I believe all episodes have dropped, yes?
Yes.
And
they're all out there.
I mean, it's, quote, only 6 episodes. They're each about 45 minutes to an hour long, and that's a CBC podcast. You can find it wherever podcasts are downloaded, but again, content warning.
In big local time. News today, bees.
What content would you like to warn/advise listeners that you have coming up, Toby?
Well, you can always catch me on Crime Writers On. And I've got, I'm the host of The Deep Dive, which is a Patreon, a Crime Writers On Patreon thing we're having. I just recorded, it's actually a great conversation about the book Say Nothing by Patrick Radden Keefe, which is about the troubles in Northern Ireland during the mostly during the 70s and 80s, but then also into the 90s.
It's really good.
It's a great, great book. And I had 2 great guests, one of whom is a journalist from Halifax, and the other one is a professor at Trinity College Dublin, who actually lives in Belfast and grew up in Northern Ireland, who just had a lot of, I mean, they both did. They both had a lot of really good insights to the point where there are times where I was just kind of sitting back listening to them talk, which I think is sometimes a good sign.
Yeah, for sure.
Anyway, so that's kind of... that's the place. Those are the places to get me. And then here every month or so.
It's true. Thank you so much for coming back, and enjoy your turkey.
You as well.
Thanks. Coming up on The Blotter Presents, Kevin Smokler is coming back to talk about the Detective Trap podcast and Savage Appetites. So get that one out of the library now. And next time, it's Buncee versus DVR. Who will prevail? Spoiler, probably not Buncee. Until then, if you've got a tip for The Blotter Presents, you can find me on social media, Blotter Presents on Twitter and Instagram, and of course, at Best Evidence. That's bestevidence.fyi. Just $5 a month, it makes a great gift, but there are also free subscriptions available. If you like the podcast, please tell a friend and rate it on your podcast app of choice. My guest has been Toby Ball, and he is on Twitter at TobyBallNH. I'm Sarah D. Bunting, and I confidentially inform you that I hope you'll tune in next time.